This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Today, we're talking about the incredible mysteries of the human brain. So let's take a listen to what brain activity actually sounds like. That's the sound of the electricity generated by a single brain cell. Your brain has somewhere around 100 billion neurons, each connected to thousands of others, enabling us to see, hear, speak, analyze, and remember. Siddhartha Gautama Buddha is famously quoted as saying, "The mind is everything. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. What we think, we become." And it turns out, he was right. From optical illusions to placebo effect and the power of meditation, modern neuroscience is affirming the ability, the amazing ability of our brains to shape our reality. Figuring out how the brain does what it does, though, that is one of the great mysteries of our age. Dr. Andre Fenton is a professor at the Center for Neural Science at New York University and founder of Biosignal Group Corporation. His research focuses on questions relating to memory, the specifics of how our brains selectively store and recall information. Dr. Andre Fenton, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks for having me.
Three quotes from Siddhartha Gautama Buddha, the Buddha. And we'll start with just the first two parts of this. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. The mind is everything. Is this really what neuroscience is telling us at this point? Is there really no objective reality, only our own perception of it?
So that's a great, deep, and ancient question. I have to say, a lot of what we've been doing in neuroscience is to sort of circumvent and skirt that question, which is to understand how the brain represents the external world. However, the more we look and the more I seem to understand the findings of how proteins and neurons organize information, it becomes really pretty clear that we are creating internal representations, in some sense, our own internal reality version of the external world. And those ancient sayings, that wisdom, is becoming more and more accurate in my mind.
Now, you study memory, and you say that our memories are not complete, that even as we're trying to take in information, we're making choices about what to remember and then incorporating it in our own unique ways, recalling it in our own unique ways. So talk a little bit about what we do know about the nature of our memory.
So before I talk about the nature of our memory, let me point out the nature of our experience. So when we experience the world, we actually make choices, whether conscious or not, about what it is that we actually experience. This is commonly thought of as attention. What you pay attention to, you can actually take in and understand and experience. What you don't pay attention to, in many ways, you don't experience, doesn't happen for you. So what you pay attention to is what gets encoded in your brain, in the activity of your neurons. And that's what the stuff of memory turns out to be. So right at the very beginning, at the sensory side, the input side, there's this selection process that happens. Now, you have to try and understand that your own experience is changing your brain. You store things, that's actually making physical alterations in the chemistry and in the physical connections that are available in your brain. And it's with that same brain that you're going to subsequently try and recollect information. Usually those recollections are triggered by external stuff in the environment, the stuff that you're paying attention to. And now there's an interesting interaction that happens between what's happening in the external world and, if you will, the mind or brain that you are now experiencing that external stuff with, which may or may not be prepared in a particular way to absorb what is actually happening. So there's a two-way street, if you will, and an interaction between what's actually happening in the world, the brain and your history that you have brought to this world, and how you will both understand it, how you'll pay attention to it, and how you will interpret it.
Now, I watched a video of you giving a talk about some of this, in which you were showing essentially some optical illusions. And one that is a classic is that you show this kind of grayscale image, and most adults will see it as two nude people, a man and a woman, embracing. And yet children see it as dolphins.
Right. So that's one of my favorite optical illusions, It's a painting by Sandro Del Prete, and that shows very nicely what I've just been describing. So adults tend to see the couple in an intimate embrace in large part because they're familiar with that. Their brains, if you will, are familiar with that. Their brains have been tuned to recognize that and interpret the world in that way. Whereas the brains of innocence, if you will, or children who have not experienced physical intimacy between a couple don't see it that way and are therefore allowed, if I can say it this way, to see what else there might be. And they recognize the dolphins very easily. In fact, many adults, after you tell them that they're dolphins, there are 9 dolphins in there, have real difficulty seeing the dolphins, even as we trace the dolphins out. And we know a fair bit about the gestalt psychology and such that might go into that. What we tend not to know about, because it's hard to study, is the actual brain mechanisms that are responsible for that. But it's easy to infer that the brain has stored certain representations of the world, and it's using what it has stored in order to interpret what is now being presented with.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with neuroscientist Dr. Andre Fenton about his research on memory and why what he's learning gives us hope for treating debilitating brain diseases. Now, Andre, let's talk a little bit about just the basic structure of the brain. I mean, this is an incredibly complex organ, and I think we tend to think of it as the most complex organ. You actually say in a lot of ways there are parallels between the brain and the heart. In that they're both electrical organs, and is the brain really more complex than other organs in the body?
So certainly from my point of view, the brain is very likely the most complex system in the universe. It's made up of a lot of discrete elements called neurons. They, in the human brain, there are order 100 billion or so of these, maybe 80 billion if you want a more precise estimate. Now, they're not just individual elements called neurons in there. Those neurons actually make connections with each other. And each neuron makes something on the order of 10,000 connections. So we have trillions of these connections. And you can think of those connections as relationships or the opportunities for relationships. And use the analogy of relationships amongst a society of people. So you can get very complicated and incredible complexities in a society of people, discrete elements, through their relationships with each other. You get two bankers together, or a banker and an entrepreneur, or you get a mother and a father together, or a two children together. You get very different interactions because of those potentials for relationships. You can make wars. You can make peace. You can make wonderful art. You can do wonderful science. You can have a flourishing society. You can have a society living in fear, again, largely because of these relationships. And so within the brain, the activity of these neurons that respond to stuff on the outside and the internal representations of that outside stuff, those interactions amongst those many billions of neurons allow for modifications of the relationships amongst the neurons. That's how we represent information. That's how we transpose information. And it's those relationships that govern all of the things that we can do. So it's incredibly complicated in principle, but amazingly, it works. And so it has many of the elements of a heart, but it has this complexity in that there are a lot of individuals and their relationships can be altered. In the heart, it's much simpler from that point of view. There are not so many individuals. Individuals are actually wired together in more or less fixed ways. And the thing called a synapse, where those relationships happen in how information is passed from one neuron to the next, from one element to the next, isn't so complex and rich in its possibilities in most other organs.
You know, if you look at the history of studying the brain before we had the ability to look at these finer scales, much of it was looking at the shape of the brain and the very large scale structure, that there are these different regions in the brain and different structures in the brain. And then we worked our way down and scientists were looking at individual neurons. And now you're talking about these connections. Is there one of those things that we can say is more important or really the kind of determining factor? Or do we really have to be able to span all of those scales to understand what's going on in the brain.
So I think if you ask different neuroscientists that question, you'll get different answers. My answer is you actually have to study all of those scales at the same time, even in the same subject. And I can try and explain that by just observation. So whether my neurons discharge in a particular way in very large part depends on the proteins that they are expressing, which is regulated at the level of the genes that those neurons decide to activate. And they decide to activate those genes in large part because of the signaling molecules, the calcium levels, the potassium and sodium levels around that neuron, and the other signaling molecules like glutamate and dopamine and so on. Okay, when those neurons discharge, they affect other neurons, okay, that also go through the same sort of chain of events. And that, in many ways, represents what it is that I experience in the world. And those experiences, by their very nature, change, as I've described, the connectivities amongst these neurons. It changes their gene expression. So now they'll express more or less of the certain types of proteins or new ones, and can regulate that. But my behaviors in the world emerge from all of this. And my behavior actually affects the world. When I act in the world, I change the world in some mostly insignificant ways, but sometimes in very profound ways. Part of how I might change the world is through my communications with other people and my interactions with other people, which instantly feeds back just how someone looks at me because I say something or do something and that inspires a different question or a particular response. So we also have the social scale. So we're operating on the nanoscale where these molecules are regulated and various ions are present or in larger or smaller concentration, and all the way up to social scales, which span, you know, meters, kilometers, if you will, hundreds of miles when it gets to nation states and so forth. And all of this is the milieu within which gene expression, neuronal activity, behavior, and social cognition, if you will, are interacting. And it's very hard to describe the arrow as going from the nanoscale up. It goes in both directions at almost every level.
It's easy to understand why it's important to understand all those scales, but is that realistic to think that we could actually understand all of those scales from genetic material up to real-world social networks in one person?
I think that's the challenge. At some point in my career, I was hopeful that I had picked the right scale, and that was the scale of networks of neurons and their electrical activity, and it really didn't matter what the genes were because what really mattered was how neurons discharged. But that viewpoint has changed. It seems very difficult to pin down the right scale at which to study this problem. In many ways, what probably is required is to understand for a given behavior or a given set of phenomena what the appropriate necessary scales are in order to capture as much of the understanding or necessary knowledge is. But it's not clear that there's a global appropriate scale, you know, studying the parts of the brain that seem to be most activated or most engaged in a particular task, that can only get us so far. And studying the particular gene that seems to be important for a particular set of behaviors or a particular set of conditions seems not to be enough. And part of the challenge, perhaps the most important question in the brain game in my mind, is finding the right rules to understand and translate information across these levels.
At the molecular level, a few years ago, you were involved in a really groundbreaking study that the upshot was you'd found a molecule that seemed to be critical for creating memories. That was 2009. It was listed as one of the, or 2006, excuse me, it was one of, listed as one of the 10 top discoveries of the year by Science Magazine at that point. Since then, there have been some studies, though, that have have called that into question and said maybe it wasn't exactly that molecule, it was a related molecule. Where does that stand now?
So I'm so happy that you asked me that question. So PKM zeta is the molecule that we had championed and identified. We identified its importance in the 2006 studies by using an inhibitor of it called ZIP, zeta inhibitory peptide. And so what's been demonstrated repeatedly is that ZIP is capable of causing memories that were formed and seem to be persisting to go away. So that's not controversial. What's controversial is what ZIP is actually acting on. And the two papers that were published a little bit more than a year ago now, about a year and a half ago, used a genetic technique to remove PKM zeta from the genetic material in mice, so a knockout mouse. And there are two independent studies that made two different forms of this knockout mouse. And what, in my opinion, they failed to find that we have subsequently been studying and have found is when you knock out PKM zeta, the brain or neurons seem to compensate for that in some way. And the compensation is an alternative form of the class of molecule, which is called a protein kinase C. PKM zeta is a form of that. So when you knock out PKM zeta, what we find is that there's a massive compensation and upregulation of a related PKC called PKC iota lambda, iota or lambda, depending on if you're a human or a non-human. And we find that it upregulates, you know, more than four or eight times even, depending on what form of it you look for. The neat thing is, it's not that those researchers didn't know about this. They looked for it, but they looked for its upregulation in the whole brain. Okay? We looked for it in the whole brain and found exactly what they found, no change. But if you look for it where it is needed, so we looked for it specifically in the hippocampus, where it was necessary, presumably for forming memories and such, in those knockout mice, you find this massive upregulation. So that's one of the reasons that they came to the conclusion that they did, which is you can knock out PKM zeta. And it's true, you can knock out PKM zeta, but it's compensated by this other molecule. Now, if you look at the mouse that has this compensation and you ask, do they actually learn and remember normally? In our hands, they do not. Okay? They have a learning impairment and they have a memory impairment. They can sort of, if you will, limp along in terms of the memory processes. But if you actually ask them to really remember or really learn something to an expert level, they're incapable of doing that in our hands.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Andre Fenton, professor at the Center for Neuroscience at New York University and founder of Biosignal Group Corporation. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Most of us wouldn't mind giving our memory a bit of a boost. Millions of people play brain games and take dietary supplements in an attempt to do just that. My guest today, though, has a more scientific approach to altering memories. He can not only enhance memories, but also erase them. Dr. Andre Fenton is professor at the Center for Neuroscience at New York University and founder of Biosignal Group Corporation. We were talking before about the molecules, the natural molecules that are involved in actually being able to create memories and which ones are critical, which ones can perhaps be substituted a little bit. But then as a scientist, you can, at least in rodents, you can go in and play with these. That's how you first discovered this molecule, is by knocking it out. Where do we stand on being able to actually, with a chemical or some other sort of therapeutic agent, actually be able to alter somebody's memory capabilities?
So that's an important question. The thing I'd like to point out is that our research is really aimed at trying to understand what the neurobiological basis of memory and, you know, thinking, cognition, turns out to be. Our work is not really aimed at trying to modify memories. We do the memory modification as an assay, if you will, to check whether our ideas are correct. we make a prediction. If PKM zeta is important for the storage of memory, or if PK Ci iota lambda is important for the maintenance of memory, if after learning I wait a long time and then interfere with that molecule, the prediction is the animal should no longer have memories but be able to learn new things, right? So that's sort of the process. What this tells us, though, is that we're beginning to understand the nuts and bolts, if you will, of some of these pretty important human-making functions, like the memories that I form and that help create my personality and who I am. The good news is that we're making headway. I think, in my opinion at least, the bad news is that we're really just sort of scratching the surface and we're beginning to understand. So we were discussing just earlier that when experimenters remove PKM zeta, the ability to make that by knocking out the gene, the brain neurons compensate for that in ways that were surprising, and it took a lot of smart people working for years to figure out. Well, the same is very likely for any manipulation. One of the nice things about a brain is that there's enormous amount of feedback at all levels in the brain. At the social level, if I start acting inappropriately, there are social mechanisms in place to feed back and get me to behave within the confines and within the rules of the society. The same thing happens within neurons. If neurons become overly excited or too powerful in their connections, there are very strong feedback mechanisms to cause them to dampen their responses. The same happens at the level of the genome. A key molecule that achieves a particular function within cells that increase, for example, their excitability or decreases their excitability feeds back and causes genetic alterations that will adjust that to keep homeostasis. It's a really profound and important concept. Biological systems like to not change and stay within certain operating parameters. So recognizing that, as we build these insights, we also have to understand that just going in and hoping that you can make this little tiny manipulation and not have consequences that are widespread and perhaps unexpected, most likely devastating, gives us a lot of pause, if you will. So I think part of what I'm being shown by studying molecules like PKM zeta is not only can we see which molecules get expressed, but the next question is even harder. They're not expressed everywhere. So where are they expressed? And it's not thinking about it in terms of, oh, it's only expressed in the hippocampus. I can show you a single hippocampal neuron that has different regions of that neuron. That neuron is only a couple of hundred microns long, but in the distal part of it, it can express a lot of PKM zeta, and in the middle part of it, it doesn't express much PKM zeta. And that's actually important, because what it's doing is it's defining a set of circuits functionally, not anatomically, but functionally, through which information can pass. If we go back to our analogy of a society, everybody doesn't talk to everyone else. Information can pass through this town of Woods Hole through certain social networks. Some people who live here all year round talk to each other about certain kinds of information, and information can spread about who's getting married, for example, or who's given birth quite rapidly through that network. But embedded in the same society are a bunch of people who are doing research, for example, on a particular potassium channel, and information and discoveries about that can pass very rapidly through that social network, but not the other one. And it's not because there are different individuals involved necessarily, but different communication channels that the same individual might be involved in. And the brain is working in a very similar way. And so single neurons can express and change how they are interacting with other single neurons. And remember, each neuron is interacting with about 10,000 or so other neurons. So you end up with these very well-defined, and if they're not well-defined, at least fuzzily defined, communication networks. And so just saying I'm going to change the amount of a gene available, or the amount of a protein, rather, available, is unlikely to be a good description of how memories are stored, how they're preserved, how they're maintained. We'll need to understand much better how those molecules are regulated at a very small scale. And ideally, we'll understand the rules that govern this regulation. And when we understand those rules, those general principles, it's very likely by understanding those rules and building tools and therapies and manipulations that respect those rules that we'll be able to get to the fantastical things like deleting, modifying, creating information that a person can be modified in their output and their understanding and their beliefs of the world. But I think, in my opinion at least, we'll have to understand those rules, not simply the players, not simply the elements.
I mean, this gets back to your whole point about you have to understand these processes at the full scale, from molecules, not even just where they are in the brain, but where they are in individual cells, and how that whole scale, all the way up to the top scale, I guess, being the real world social and environmental settings. Are we at a point, though, where we could potentially, you know, say, okay, the drugs are, a pharmaceutical route is probably not responsible at this point, because we don't understand all of the rules at those fine scales. But given the power of experience and how we interact with, our brain interacts with the real world to make molecular and physiological changes in our brain, can we use that as a kind of therapy? I mean, in one case, does playing brain games really have a physiological effect, and can we change our memory and our mental function in that way?
I absolutely believe so. Just recently, I blurted out that, you know, experience might be the best brain medicine. And by that I mean brains function, to the best of our knowledge, as these circuits that have been laid down through genetic programming and what we call development. Okay. But these circuits are then, and that might be, you could think of that as analogous to the urban infrastructure or something like that, a bunch of roads that have been laid down. But then on top of that, experience modifies how those roads are used, what those circuits are used for, whether they become specialized. So certain parts of a city or a town become the central business district. They are biased to become that because of maybe many roads lead there and it's easy to get there. They can be influenced by having particular zoning laws and infrastructural rules and relaxations of rules to cause that to happen. But nobody plans which buildings and which banks will build their buildings at the central business district and such. That happens in large part by chance, at least initially. But then the fact that a particular enterprise is in one place is going to influence the likelihood of another enterprise that needs the same sorts of resources being there, and so on. And brains, I think, work in a similar way. Experience is changing these interrelationships of how the circuit is actually used. And what's neat about that is it's doing so in the lawful ways that we don't understand, right? So the brain, a normal brain, even an abnormal brain, is behaving and operating in many ways in adherence to most of the rules that we're, as neuroscientists, trying to discover. And so the fantasy is, if you can start to understand, at least my fantasy, if you can start to understand experience very much along the lines, to me the analogy is good to like a physical therapist. A physical therapist understands how bones are related to muscles and how they fit in sockets and so forth. And so if you have a particular ailment or a particular, you know, non-optimal function of a shoulder joint, they understand, well, maybe you have a muscle that's a little too tense or a little too strong, and you need to strengthen this other one and weaken that one. And by having that kind of understanding, they can direct you in the kinds of exercises you might do in order to modify the system that is your muscles and skeleton. You could do the same thing with the brain.
I mean, you say we could, but do we have that knowledge yet to know which experiences? You know, there's a ton of advice out there, you know, play this game or go dancing or exercise or you know, recommending essentially different kinds of experience mm-hmm. that our brain incorporates in different ways. Do we know yet what the specific experiences or activities are that different people need to meet different goals?
I don't think we're quite there, but we're close. So there have been a number of nice studies demonstrating that, you know, particular class of computer game, for example, that is both enjoyable but is really asking a person to do something more or less like focus their attention. So there are a bunch of distracting things. You could implement this in a driving game, for example, where you have to avoid red potholes and hit red things that are, you know, give you fuel or something like that. And by training someone to actually evaluate information, discard what is recognizably irrelevant, and use what's relevant, that kind of training seems to be beneficial, is demonstrated to be generally beneficial to an aged population. There's a nice set of studies and work coming out of the psychiatry department at University of California, San Diego, where they're giving computer training, cognitive therapy, if you will, to schizophrenic and other psychiatric patients and demonstrating long-lasting positive outcomes. What we don't know and what we don't have is we have a good intuition about why that might be, but what we don't really understand is what neural circuits and what neural circuit changes have actually been modified and created. We understand more or less which parts of the brain might have been engaged, and we can come up with reasonable guesses as to what kinds of activity patterns were likely to have been engaged by those practices. What we really don't know is the detailed, by analogy, the knowledge that the physical therapist has as to exactly what parts of those circuits and how those circuit interactions have been altered and how they affect other circuit interactions. That's what we need to work further on, and that's one of our research programs.
Do you think that the kind of cognitive therapy that you're talking about, take for example schizophrenia, we kind of as a society jumped to pharmaceutical interventions, giving people drugs to treat mental illnesses, and you've already said that given our incomplete understanding of the full scale of brain processes, those drugs can have all sorts of unintended consequences. Could cognitive therapy replace pharmaceutical therapy and perhaps be a safer alternative or an alternative with fewer side effects?
So that's a speculation. If I could wish that it would be a sufficient replacement. You know, the fact to remember is that there are a lot of sick people who need help today, and we don't know how to help them better than the pharmaceutical treatments that are available. The other really important fact, in particular for schizophrenia, is that we know those treatments are ineffective, but they're what we have. They help manage illnesses that are happening today. Part of my mission and what I feel as an important part of the research enterprise is to try and help psychiatrists and the pharmaceutical drug discovery industry think better about how to approach these problems. So I'll give you a fantasy. In fact, I'll give you some data first and then a fantasy that we infer from that. So we were able to demonstrate in a paper published maybe two summers ago that we could damage the brain of a baby rat, a newborn rat, analogous to causing a trauma in the third trimester of a human birth from terms of brain development, which is a condition that we think happens and biases people to develop mental illnesses like schizophrenia. But what we definitely did was we damaged the brains of these pups. They grew up. And when they become adults, they start to demonstrate all sorts of problems that are analogous to having something like schizophrenia or a mental illness. And so what we were able to demonstrate is that when they were adolescent, by, say, around age equivalent in brain development, age 13 or so in human terms, we gave them, let's see, just short of 3 hours of cognitive exercise. We basically taught them how to, or that it was important to ignore distracting things and focus, if you will, on what was relevant in their world. During about three hours, 160 minutes of this training. They were capable of doing that when they were at this adolescent age, and then we put them back in their cage. And what was remarkable is when we brought them back as adults, they could do that task. They could do other tasks that they had never experienced that required being able to focus on what was relevant and ignore distraction. And when we looked in the brain, they had just as much brain damage as the animals that didn't have this training, but their brains functioned differently. We could look at the electrical activity and see that their brains were better organized in how information or and the electrical discharge, the electrical oscillations that we can study, were different and more or less normal in those brains that had huge, ugly holes in them, swollen ventricles and so on. So this is a demonstration that the right kind of training is able to cause brains to change, and they can cause brains to change in ways that we sort of understand, such that function can be restored, even if the substrate, if you will, is itself damaged and broken. So my fantasy then is that if we understood better some of the rules here, what the neurobiology of the brain plasticity is and how cognitive training is able to adjust brain function, then what we might be able to do is to say, oh, we have all of this technology. We know that you're at risk, not only from your family history, but your genetic endowment and so forth. And we have early signs of saying you're at risk for developing this terrible disease. Now would be a good time to engage in some kind of mental, if you will, training. Call it cognitive behavioral therapy if you want. It'll probably have some other name. But let us use experience to help guide the development and training of your mind so that when you grow up and these genes and the environmental insults that you've suffered are going to now produce this debilitating set of consequences, your mind will be better prepared to manage that information. So we can even fantasize a little further than that. A lot of people didn't have that opportunity when they were adolescent. And the key about adolescence is this is a time of one's life where your brain is actually in a hyper-changeable state. It has many of the molecular and genetic programs that allow for alteration in a, you know, operating at a high-ish level. Well, maybe the right thing to do for the people who didn't have that opportunity is to give them the right kinds of drugs, not to fix their problem per se, but to put their brains into this more plastic state and then give them the right kinds of mental training. Because with that training and a more malleable set of neural circuits, you might end up in a situation where you get better outcomes. So that would be my fantasy for how we do this. There's no point in throwing away useful tools and useful knowledge.
I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Andre Fenton. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Andre Fenton, professor at the Center for Neuroscience at New York University and founder of Biosignal Group Corporation. He's described himself as a biodetective. Certainly the human brain is one of the great mysteries. Andre Fenton, how did you first become interested in neuroscience?
So I've always been interested in many ways in me, you know, how I am, how I think and feel about the world, you know, ever since I can remember. And I thought I would understand that through philosophy and English. So that's what I went to do when I got to college. But I always was interested in biology also. not for any obvious reason to me. Perhaps I liked it and it seemed to make some sense that you could understand life through biology. And what really was important to me was that I went to a lecture as an undergraduate, a biology lecture, in which a professor at McGill, my alma mater, Ron Chase, described a set of experiments that are known as, the title of the paper is What the Frog's Eye Tells the Frog's Brain. And basically, these were experiments done by Jerry Levin, who recently died, but they were incredibly influential, and in particular influential for me, because what they showed was that the frog's reality, if you will, visual reality, was different from my visual reality. They were measuring under the assumption that if a frog was able to see something in the world, there should be a change in the activity in the connection between the frog's retina and the frog's brain. So if they couldn't measure a change in the optic nerve activity, one imagined that the frog was ignorant, or, you know, this thing didn't do anything for the frog visually. And so they were able to demonstrate that frogs sort of see dark spots that move, but they don't see dark spots that don't move, for example. So frogs are tuned to see flies that are flying and not well tuned to see flies that are not flying. I can see flies that don't fly. And so that really, to me, was fascinating, because it kind of answered one of the questions that I always wondered, which was, and what's the nature of my reality? Is it that I see and experience a particular version of the world that is Andre Fenton's? Well, this said to me very clearly, you do. It might be the same as other humans, but it's definitely different than a frog's. And so it didn't take much for me to infer that, maybe Andre Fenton's version of his brain is actually different than the version of brain that other people might have. And so my reality is actually fairly subjective, and it was no longer conjecture. And that, being able to sort of come to that conclusion myself, I'm not sure it's the right conclusion, but I felt secure in that, said to me, wow, you should study neuroscience. You know, neurobiology actually allows you to answer in a pretty compelling and satisfying way some of these questions that I've always been curious about. And so from then on, I started studying neurons.
Now, if you operate on the assumption that we all have our own reality that's being created within our brain, you, to study that, are often studying mice or rats and are in some way altering their brain. Does it ever weigh on you that you are altering the reality of another living organism? I mean, you are, by altering their memory and their brain function, completely altering what to us would be our self-identity in our world.
It occurs to me all the time. In fact, that's why I'm interested in doing it. I suppose I'm a utilitarian, ethically and such. And I think trying to understand who we are, how we think about our world, how we experience the world, has enormous value. If we can understand that correctly, in my, you know, optimistic way of seeing the world, I think it will change how we behave with respect to each other, with respect to other animals, with respect to the environment in general. But we first have to understand that viewpoint. And so I see culture and society as an evolving thing. I see ethics as an evolving thing. And I'll be, you know, really very proud to demonstrate to us that we actually should stop working on animals, because we're actually, you know, they have minds that are sentient, and they have the same kinds of rights, if you will, to beinghood and so forth that we have. If I could demonstrate that, I would feel very, very proud and satisfied, and it would change what I do. If I'm confronted with information that I understand and find compelling, I change how I behave, and I'll be very happy to be a participant in that evolution, if you will, of culture.
You have changed your behavior, or at least molded your behavior, whether it was a major change, around some of your understandings. You meditate, you take in from the neurobiology what you're learning and incorporate into your own life. So give us some insight into what you do that you think helps perhaps your mental health or boosts your mental function.
Right. So after everything I've said, it's pretty clear that I consider what I do with my brain, which means my experience or life, is pretty important to me. So I do my very best to, if not focus, at least be deliberate about what I engage in, whether it seems casual or not. I find it very difficult to actually sit and meditate in sort of isolation, but I spend a lot of my time doing the same sort of meditative practices while, for example, I'm walking home with the groceries, while I'm moving from one place to another. Sometimes I exercise by running. Sometimes I exercise by biking. Quite often I spend a lot of time just practicing the skill of focusing on something. So that's one of my favorite ways of passing time, to just sit there or lie there or while walking, while executing something fairly mechanical, trying very hard to hold a particular kind of thought or a particular kind of non-thought in my mind. And I'm getting better at it because it's a skill. And I think whatever it takes to do that, that skill is a generally very valuable skill, because most things that I do in my professional life require being very attentive to the matters that I've chosen to be attentive to and to ignore for the time being, not forever, but to ignore for the time being those other things that are demanding of my brain resources. And the same thing happens in my family. So when it's time for my, daughter's birthday party, I really want to be attentive to that and not be distractible by all the other things that are going on, whether good or bad, in the other aspects of my life. So that's the practice that I do.
That kind of mindfulness practice is something that is often recommended by, I guess it comes from Buddhism and is kind of a more popular recommendation today. Do you think heed those recommendations if they were not also backed up by your own hard science?
So that's an interesting question. I think the empirical evidence is no, I would not heed them until through my own experience and through the kinds of inquiries that I've made through science, they make a lot of sense to me. So I have a very close friend, my best friend from high school, Nathaniel Morlando. He is a practicing Buddhist, and he's become so. And so his education and prior life, he's now a filmmaker, was as a philosopher. So we have these very intense discussions whenever we meet around what is the appropriate way to spend your time? What should you engage your mind with? And what's quite remarkable is if you just follow the prescriptions that might emerge sort of rationally from the neuroscientific knowledge that I have, it's remarkable how similar the prescriptions of what you do with your mind are to his understanding from his investigations and teachings from a Buddhist tradition. It's truly, truly remarkable.
Dr. Andre Fenton, we're going to have to let you go. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.